Side 5, Marl Fox by Brian Jakes. Continuing on page 203. Still hanging upside down, Dippler and Burble watched in awed silence as the warrior blood of Urguba rose in their companion's eyes. Spitting water and roaring, his weapon forgotten, Dan hauled Raventail almost clear of the creek and dealt him a fierce blow. Flinging the screaming ferret from him, Dan dived after his enemy, pummeling with all four paws, kicking, punching, and baring his teeth as he thrashed the vermin unmercifully. Raguba! 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 Song ran out to the bankside to watch the spectacle. She had never seen another creature take such a ferocious beating. Dan, leave him alone! He's had enough! But Dan was past listening. Grabbing Raventail, he hauled him over his head and flung him bodily into the marshy border of the creek's far side. Black with sludge, and unable to stand, the ferret crawled away up the bank. Dan went after him, but he stumbled and fell in the mud among clumps of blue-flowering plants. Swiftly, Song untied the boat and leapt in, giving a hard shove against the willow trunk with her paddle. The swallow shot smoothly out across the dark surface, slowing neatly as it nosed into the blue flower surrounding Dan. Song passed him the mooring rope. "Here, mate, grab this." Total exhaustion suddenly enveloped Dan. Gratefully, he held on to the rope and lay back, while Song paddled back to the bank. The Raguba warrior was hauled dripping onto the mossy sward by Song, and sat shivering as reaction to his wild charge set in. Song found his sword in the shallows. "Great seasons, what a fighter you are, Dan! I never saw anything like that in my whole life. You are like a badger lord in blood wrath there. I was sure you were going to slay that vermin bare-pawed."
"Yes, yes, but are you going to talk about it all day and leave us two poor creatures hanging here like apples waiting for autumn?"
Song turned to the two wet bundles hanging from the willow bough.
"Oops, sorry, pals, I completely forgot you there for a moment. Hang on, I'll soon get you down."
Viewing the scene from his upside-down position, Burble winked at Dan.
"Ah, well, isn't that decent of the young missy now? She's getting round to releasing us. Iffen she don't put a move on with it, we'll both have great fat purple heads with hanging this way."
The irony of the water bowl's remarks was not lost on Song. Smiling mischievously, she crouched with her face level to Burble's.
Then again I might just leave you to ripen and drop off like two damsons in the orchard. How long is it till autumn, Dan?"
Struggling upright, Dan swung Dippler in so that Song could cut his bonds, and together they lowered him onto the moss. The Gwasom Shrew had not said a word throughout his ordeal. Now he sat rubbing circulation back into his footpaws as he spoke.
"Sleeping again, I was. Same as last time when the Marl Foxes stole my tribe's logboats."
"Huh. Haven't learned much, have I? Same puddle-headed beast as ever I was. That's me."
When they had cut Burble down, Dan sat by Dippler and put a friendly paw about his shoulders.
"Don't blame yourself, Dip. We were all asleep. It wasn't your fault. Next time you'll be ready. Wait and see. I think you'll surprise yourself when the time comes. I certainly did. After what took place here today, I'll never be afraid of any creature living. What do you say, Song?"
The squirrel maid tossed her leafwood in the air and caught it deftly.
"Don't think 'tis a question of you being afraid any more, Dan. In the seasons to come, any foe beast facing you will be the one who feels the fear, of that I'm sure."
As the afternoon wore on, the four friends sat on the bank discussing their next move. Burble was not happy about going back to the river.
"'Tisn't the thing to do, you see. That old Grey One and the River-Ed tribe will scour that open water for days yet. Yes, yes, we'll only be like a butterfly flying into the mouth of a hungry crow, going straight into trouble, so we will."
Song glanced up from the scroll that contained Friar Butty's rhyme, which she had been studying carefully.
"You could be right, Burb. The river might be a dangerous place for us. You say we weren't far off some rapids when your tribe were chasing us. Is that correct?" "Oh, yes, yes, missy. The old rapids are fast and fierce. 'Tis a good job we never had to face them, so 'tis. Yes, yes."
Song tapped the parchment thoughtfully.
It doesn't say anything in this rhyme about going over rapids on the river this early. All it says is, "Just follow as I run away. Discover the speechless hidden mouth. Alas, my friends, our ways part there. Go down green tunnel, bound in south, through trees with blossoms in their hair."
Dan poured them the last of the dandelion and burdock cordial.
"So, what does that tell us, Song? Think on it a bit, Dan. While we were following that river, did we see any streams or creeks running south before this one?
No, I'm sure we didn't. There wasn't a break in the bank until I saw this side stream when they were chasing us. What are you getting at, Song?
Well, 'tis just an idea, but I think this is the speechless hidden mouth we were looking for. Dippler, you know about waterways. What's your opinion?
The Gwassam Shrew scratched his whiskers.
Maybe so. The inlet does look a touch like a mouth, and all that foliage makes it a proper green tunnel. So if your poem says that's where our ways part, it must mean that is the spot where we part company with the river.
Aye, I think you're right, Song.
But Burble scoffed at the idea. Ah, will you listen to the wisdom of them? How can words on an old scrap of parchment be right? This is a dead end. Or is it myself as the only one can see it?
Song shook the scroll beneath Burble's nose. Remember, though, this was written many, many seasons ago. Couldn't this have been a proper stream before that? Mightn't it only have become a creek after those trees fell and blocked it?
Dippler butted in.
Ha! But you forgot something, missy. Aren't we supposed to be chasing the Marl Fox and his crew?
Song stood up and stamped about on the bank. She was fast losing patience with the whole affair.
Look, I don't care which way the fox has gone. We can't follow on the open river with Gray One on our tails.
Another thing, we know the Marl Fox is bound for the secret island on the Lost Lake. This way, we're sure to meet up with him. Burble, where do you think you're off to?
The water vole was already climbing over the fallen tree trunks that blocked the creek off.
Don't get your paws in a tizzy, Bossy Tail. I'm just going to see if your idea is right, Yis-Yis. Well, are you coming?
They climbed over the trunks and inspected the ground. Among the clumps of agrimony, sawwort, and saxifrage, the old stream bed was still identifiable by the narrow trickle of water filtering through the logs that had dammed it off. Song splashed about in it triumphantly.
You see, I told you this is the side stream we're supposed to take. Look, it's running south, just like the rhyme said it would.
What do you say to that, Fatty Bull Nose?
Burble had only one word to say.
Porterage.
They stared at him, repeating the word together.
Porterage?
Yes, yes. Have you not heard of porterage?
Well, I'll tell you, my fine furred friends. It means that we've got to follow this little water trickle till it becomes a stream again.
Yes, yes. A carrion the good boat swallow upside down on our heads.
Dan started climbing back over the tree trunks.
Stands to sense, Burb. We'd never get anywhere trying to float the swallow in that tiny dribble. Come on, porters, let's try a bit of porterage. I'm game, if you lot are.
Fortunately, the swallow was a comparatively light craft. Shouldering their packs and placing the paddles flat across their shoulders, the friends turned her upside down, lifted her over their heads, then lowered her onto the outstretched blades. This meant that their heads were inside the upturned boat, and one had to follow the other blindly. Dan took the lead, being the tallest, followed by Dippler and Burble, with Song at the rear of the line. It was hard going, hot and stuffy inside the boat, where they were visited by various winged pests. However, they pressed on stoically, trying to ignore the hardships.
Dunk!
Youch! Watch where you're going up there, Dan.
Sorry. 'Twas a big overhanging branch. Didn't see it.
Yes, yes. Maybe you didn't see it, matey. But we felt it.
Well, so did I, so stop complaining, will you?
Burb ain't complaining. He's debating. Creature's got a right to debate, water voles as well as us shrews.
Anyhow, how can you tell if we're going the right way, Dan?
Puddin'head.
Because I'm walking in a little stream, and me footpaws are soaking wet and soggy, that's how.
Song, will you please sing a ditty or two to shut that pair up?
Honestly, talk about Gabby. Gwassam and Wafflin' Waterbowls, spare me from them.
Song liked the way her voice echoed inside the upturned boat.
Oh, how could a hedgehog marry a mole? He's prickly, 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 and live with a squirrel all in a great hole, very tickly, tickly, tickly. And what if an otter could dance with a trout? He'd stay in the river and never come out. Pray tell me whatever they'd all think of me, inviting a bumblebee in for its tea.
Why, they'd come in and join us, for goodness sake, for scones and trifle and blueberry cake, elderflower cordial and strawberry pie. Oh, turn, caterpillar, to bright butterfly. Burble stubbed his football on a stone, which did not improve his argumentative mood. "Chah! Hedgehogs and squirrels and bumblebees eating cake and supping cordial together? Don't make much sense, do it. Youch! Do you mind not walking on the backs of my footpaws, missy?" "Sorry, Burb. And I'm sorry you didn't like my song. 'Tis only an old nonsense ditty my grandma Elio used to sing to me." The water vole trudged on unappeased. "Oh, yes, yes. 'Tis nonsense, all right. No mistake in that. Grr. Listen, Mr. Wasp. Keep away from my nose, or I'll eat you." Dan could not restrain himself from laughing at Burble. "Chattin' to wasps now, Burb? Come on, you old grouch. Let's see if you can sing us a song that makes sense." Burble sniffed. "All water vole songs make sense. Listen. A water vole grows like an old bulrush stalk and learns to swim before he can walk. Just give him a paddle and lend him a boat. There's naught as nice as a vole what's afloat. Go ruggle your tuckle and roggle your blot. Come flugle your wattle and pickle your swat. A water vole's clever and smart and he's nice. He won't take a boat out onto the ice, but he'll live all his life in a comfy old cave. And when he dies, it'll do for his grave. So twangle me girdle and griddle me twog, right burgle me doodle and frumple me plog." Dipler tried to keep a straight face as he nodded wisely. "Burgle me doodle and frumple me plog? Makes perfect sense. What do you think, Dan?" A deep booming voice that did not belong to Dan rang out. "Ho, ho, ho, ho! Now I've seen everything, a singing boat. Hoo, hoo, hoo!" The four friends whipped the swallow off their heads to see who it was. The hugest, fattest, most spiky hedgehog that any of them had ever seen was lying in an immense hammock, slung between a beech and an elm. Spikes and quills stuck through the coarse canvas of the hammock, making it look like a monstrous pincushion. He had two baskets, one on either side of the hammock, containing wild grapes and almonds. In his paw he brandished a giant mallet to crack the nuts with, and this he waved cheerily at the travelers. "Good noontide to you. Fancy some grapes? A few nuts, maybe? Come sit and rest yourselves, poor little waifs." Song smiled and waved back prettily to him, commenting to the others, "We could do with a rest. What do you say, poor little waifs?" With a grunt and a groan, the big hedgehog heaved himself out of the hammock and bowed politely. "I go by the name of Saul. Full name's Solar Tree, 'cause I'm the only hedgehog in these parts. Now, what be your given names, me little hinfants?" Song introduced herself and her friends. "I'm Song, he's Dan, and that's Burble and Dipler. Excuse me, sir, but shouldn't your name be Solitary?" The big fellow waved a paw airily. "Solitary, Solitary. What difference, pretty one? Save that Solitary is the name I gave myself, and I like it fine. Come, sit you down on my hammock. A more comfy berth you never found, eh?" They sat on the hammock's edge, gently swinging back and forth. Apart from the odd spike that had to be removed from the canvas, they all agreed it was very comfortable. Saul smiled with pleasure. "High deal, high deal. Now you help yourselves to grapes while I crack some almonds for you. Grow 'em all myself. Nothing better for putting a twinkle in your eye and a point to your spikes." The grapes were delicious, small but plump and juicy. Saul sat on a tree stump, lining almonds up and popping them gently with his giant mallet. "Isn't it lonely, Mr. Saul, living alone in the midst of the woods with no beast for company?" Dan asked. Saul passed them a great pawful of kernels, raising his bushy brows. "Lonely? What's lonely? Great shells and vines. How could a body get lonely round here, little bushtail? I got birds to sing for me, sunshine, showers, fresh breezes to ruffle the hair of my lovely trees, clear water to drink. Oh, and croakle, too." He reached down by the side of the stump, and a small green frog hopped onto his plate-like paw. Saul grinned happily. "Croakle, these are my new friends. Bid 'em good noontide, will you?" The frog's tiny green throat bulged out. "Croakle." This seemed to amuse Saul greatly. "Ho, ho, ho, ho! 'Tis all he ever says. Croakle. And who, pray, could argue with that? Listen to this. You're a great fierce beast who slayed thousands, aren't you, mate? The frog gazed at him with its small golden eyes.
Croikle?
Saul laughed until his spikes rattled, and the four travelers could not resist laughing along with the simple-hearted giant. He passed them more almonds and grapes.
See? My friend's never in a bad mood, never argues or grizzles. Go on, ask him a question.
Dippler winked at the little frog.
Saul tells me you ate 4 barrels of grapes and almonds, true?
The frog turned its gaze on the Gwasom Shrew, as if it had heard his question and was considering the answer. Then it spoke.
Croikle?
Saul nearly fell off his tree stump, laughing.
Ho, ho, hoo, hoo, hoo. He said it weren't 4 barrels. 'Twas 6.
He encouraged the others to question his frog, commenting each time the tiny creature croaked. Song, Dan, and Burble took turns.
Tell me, sir, where do you sleep at night?
Croikle? Well, I never. He said that he kicks me out of my hammock and sleeps there every night. Hoo, 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 hoo.
Is it true that frogs like to swim in the stream?
Croikle. What, swim, says he? Never. I've got me own little boat, he says. Mr. Saul made it out of an almond shell. Ho, 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 ho.
Sir, you look like a fine singer. Would you sing us a song?
Croikle. Did you hear that? He just sang his favorite song, the shortest one ever written.
My, my, what a clever frog.
Ho, 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 hoo, hoo.
The banter went back and forth, until noon shadows began to lengthen. Song was enjoying herself, but she thought it was time they made ready to depart. Saul was busy crushing a grape, removing the pips, and feeding it to Croikle, as she explained it all to him, but he nodded his head understandingly.
Fear not, little'uns. 'Tis all clear to old Saul. You want to find the stream going south, so's you can go a-sailing in your little boat. Now, 'twill take you best part of 2 days carrying the vessel, but listen to me, my dearies. I'll carry your boat and take you on a shortcut that'll have you on stream in a single day. So rest you now in my home for tonight, and we'll start out bright and early on the morrow, yes?
The reply was eagerly given by the friends.
Oh, yes, please, Mr. Saul.
The hedgehog's dwelling was a long jumble of stone slabs, timber, branches, and mud chinking, built into the side of a rock ledge. It was very homely and comfortable inside, once Saul had stirred up the fire embers and fed them with wood and sweet-smelling peat clumps. Evening cast its calm, cool spell over all, and the four friends lounged around the fire while Saul stirred a cauldron of vegetable soup, which stood on a tripod over the glow. Keeping his soft brown eyes upon the task, he began telling of his life.
I lived here all my life. There were 3 of us, my good wife Beechtip, my little daughter Nettlebud, and myself. Ah, dearie me, it do seem a long time ago now. Anyhow, it was on a misty autumn time. I'll never forget it.
I'd trekked back to the river seeking russet apples, as there was none hereabouts. Thought I might get a russet sapling to plant outside our door, so's we could grow our own. Well, on the 2nd day out, it came on to storm, when 'twas too far to make it back home. So I made a shelter on the river bank, below the rapids, and sat it out for 3 days. Then I returned here, laden with apples, and a fine young sapling tree.
Saul paused, gazing into the glowing peat fire, his face wreathed by aromatic smoke. He sighed heavily.
Ah, lackaday. Vermin had raided my home. 'Twas all ruin and wreck, with no sign of the villains. Tracks washed out by storm, you see. My poor wife Beechtip lay slain. She were a gentle creature, couldn't fight to save her life. My little daughter Nettlebud was gone, taken captive by vermin. My name was Skyspike in those days, causing me great size and strength. But alas for me, I was never a warrior. Couldn't raise my paw to hurt no living thing. Be that as it may, I went mad with grief and sorrow. 3 seasons I roamed far and wide, always searching, seeking to find my darling Nettlebud. Questing, wandering o'er woodland, water and moorland, but my poor baby was gone. Then one day in autumn, when leaves died all red gold and small birds were flying southwards to chase the sun, I found I'd roamed back to this place. I'll tell thee no lie, young friends. I sat here and wept for days, thinking on what had been. Then one morning,
I awakened to find the sun shining bright, and birds singing joyous songs to it. A great peace came o'er me, and I no longer wanted to spend my life wandering about. That was when I changed my name to Solitree, and decided to live out my season's ear. I rebuilt my house, reared little Croikle from a tadpole I had found in the trickling water, and guess what? Saul pointed out of the doorway to a tree. That sapling I'd cast away weren't no russet. 'Twas a fine young almond tree. There 'tis yonder, see? So here I am, and here I'll stay. And allow me to say this. I'll never do another creature a bad turn if and I can't do him a good'un. Song smiled at the huge spiky beast. You're a fine and rare creature, Mr. Saul. 20.
Mokun was up to his usual tricks. As dusk fell, the Marl Fox had ordered his crew to put in to shore and make camp, and now he sat in the branches of an elm, listening to his water rats talking, as they huddled in the lee of their logboat on the riverbank. From his tether in the stern of the vessel, Fenno was urging them to desertion, or mutiny.
Listen, mates, now's your chance, while Mokun's away scouting down river. Make a break for it while you still can, mates.
A rat named Gorm stared dully at the shrew.
We ain't your mates, so shut your trap.
Fenno ignored him and carried on.
See what happened today? One of you was bashed against the rocks and drowned getting over them rapids. The logboat was near wrecked, and we were almost lost altogether. But did your Marl Fox worry about that, eh?
Oh, no. All he was thinking of was that tapestry. Then Mokun had us breaking our backs, even on those paddles, to escape the Volcruz.
You there, I saw him whack you a belt with his axe handle to make your paddle faster. What sort of a leader is that, I ask you?
The rat he was addressing merely shrugged.
We serve the kin of the High Queen Silth. 'Tis no business of yours.
Fenno curled his lip at the water rat scornfully.
Huh, High Queen Silth. Look at yourselves, soaking wet and wearied to the limit. Crouching there on a damp bank without a bite between you, or a fire to dry out by. You must all be crazy. Do you think your queen cares the drop of a leaf about you lot?
The rat called Gorm banged the side of the logboat to silence Fenno.
All your fine talk's doing you no good, Gwasim. Don't you know that Marl Foxes are magic beasts? 'Twould do us no good at all trying to run from them. Where would we go? No creature can escape the magic of Marl Foxes.
Fenno strained against the thong that bound him to the boat.
Magic, my whiskers. You water rats are really stupid.
Not half as stupid as you, shrew.
Fenno actually jumped with shock. Mokun was standing behind him, holding aloft a whippy branch he had cut from the elm with his axe. The shrew covered his head with both paws, crouching in a ball, as blows rained heavily on him.
Pain is the best teacher for stupid idiots. Marl Foxes are magic. Say it. Say it.
Ugh! Yarg! Marl Foxes are magic, sire! Yarg!
Mokun threw the broken branch savagely at Fenno's head and kicked his sobbing prisoner brutally.
You've learned a valuable lesson, oaf. We've got all night. Shall I cut myself another switch to remind you of it, eh?
Crouching in the damp logboat bottom, Fenno wept brokenly.
Mercy, sire, please! Marl Foxes are magic! I won't forget, sire!
Mokun lost interest in his captive. Turning to Gorm, he said,
"Break out supplies and light a small fire. Keep it sheltered in the lee of the boat, and don't let it smoke."
The water rat bowed. "It shall be done as you say, sire."
Mokun stroked the intricately embroidered tapestry roll.
"Keep this dry and in perfect condition. High Queen Silth would be angry if it were damaged."
Queen Silth was distracting herself by paying the slaves a visit. As her palanquin was borne out to the rear courtyard, she made small mewling noises of disgust as she watched the steaming mess of porridge made from maize and chopped roots being delivered to the bars of the pen. Hungrily, the starving slaves grabbed pawfuls and gulped it down. Ulig cracked his whip and snarled,
"Be still in the presence of Her Majesty, High Queen Silth."
Immediately they quit feeding and huddled together in the darkness of the pen's back wall. Alarmed by the moody and unpredictable queen's visit, they did not know what to expect. Athrock and his magpies strutted about in front of the bars, their wicked beady eyes watching the pitiful prisoners. Rat guards stood stiffly at attention.
the odd quiver of a spear denoting that they were as apprehensive as the slaves at Silt's unexpected appearance. All eyes were on the silt-draped conveyance. Servants hurried to place torches and lanterns all around the palanquin. The stillness was ominous, as if every creature present was afraid to breathe. Nothing moved in the awful silence, except for the eerie dancing shadows cast by the flickering torches. Harsh and grating, the High Queen's voice rasped out from behind the silken veils.
"Are they working hard for the food we give them?"
Ulig, the rat captain in charge of all slaves, replied stiffly,
"Yes, Your Majesty. Some in the fields and orchards, and others in your workplace, making things of beauty to grace your chambers."
There was a further silence. Then Silt spoke once more.
Don't let them get fat and lazy, Captain. Remind them of the rules on my island.
Ulig faced the cages and shouted out the rules, veins bulging from his thick neck as he did so.
"Work and you live. And remember, there is no escape from here. Disobey, and you get fed to the teeth of the deeps. This is the rule of Her Majesty, I, Queen Silt. You stay alive only by her mercy."
There was a short silence. Then the voice from within the palanquin called out petulantly,
"Take me back inside to my chambers. I don't like it out here. There's only ugliness, nothing nice. I must be surrounded by beauty. Death will never visit where beauty reigns."
Lifting the palanquin carefully, the bearers marched off with measured tread, halting suddenly as Silth screeched,
"Stop! There it is, at the upper chamber windows. Don't you see it, fools? The White Coast. Captain, take a troop up there quickly and slay it. Hurry!"
Floating back and forth across the brightly lit window of an upper chamber, the fearful white apparition fluttered, howling,
"Queen Silth! Dark forest awaits your spirit. Death is all you have left now. Ooh!"
Ulig clattered off at the head of his troops, knowing that the specter would be gone when he reached the room upstairs. It was not the first time something like this had occurred. Blantor stowed the white ghost in its corner cupboard and poured two goblets of plum wine. Sliding one across to the rat Wilke, the Marl Fox smiled maliciously, listening to the guards hastening up the stairs.
"She'll have frightened herself to death by winter, Wilke.
And then we'll prepare a deadly reception for my returning brothers and sisters. Give me a toast, Wilke." The female water rat nodded over the rim of her goblet. "To High Queen Lontour, next ruler of this island and all the lakes surrounding it. Long life and undisturbed sleep." Lontour quaffed her goblet's contents.
"Aye, I'll drink to that. After all, who could disturb my sleep? The White Ghost?"
Wilke topped up Lontour's goblet from the wine flagon.
"How could the White Ghost disturb my lady, when 'twill be lying at the bottom of the lake, wrapped around ex-Queen Silt?"
"Hee-hee! Pour yourself more wine, Wilke."
Kregge stumped her way downstairs to find out what had been going on in her absence. The few days she had spent alone in her room had been irksome. Now recovered from her wounds, the blind badger was eager for company, longing to be part of the daily hum of Abbey life. Her tread was slow and sure, and she kept to one side of the stairs, using the wall as a guide. Every joint and crack of the ancient red sandstone, each paw-worn stair with its own small dip or hollow, the Badger Mom knew well. Redwall Abbey was her home, and she loved it so much that she felt every stone of it was part of her. Reaching Great Hall, Craig's sharp instincts told her things were not as they should be. She knew it was nighttime, and there were always Redwallers about this late in the evening, but now there was a hushed silence over everything. Moreover, her senses told her that candles and lanterns aplenty were lit, for she could feel their presence, the slight warmth, a guttering flicker, the odd drip of melted beeswax from a brimming sconce, the fragrant odor of pine resin. All was not right. Moving silently into what she knew was the shadow of a thick stone column at the edge of the hall, the big badger felt about until her paw rested on the long pole of a brass-cupped candle snuffer. Grasping it tight, she called out,
"Who's there? Speak if you know what's good for you. I don't like creatures sneaking about around me."
From somewhere out at the hall's center, a voice she identified as Friar Butty's whispered,
"One, two, three, now!"
Music burst out everywhere, fifes, drums, and all manner of stringed instruments, with massed voices singing in harmony.
Midsummer, midsummer, the solstice is here, and now we give thanks to the day. We joyfully sing like the birds on the wing, for old winter is still far away. The high sun of noontide smiles down on us all, sending warmth to the earth from on high. Soon the autumn will yield, out in orchard and field, where the bounties of nature do lie. Midsummer, midsummer, the solstice is now, in the midst of this season so bright. Yea, we sing, aye, we sing, here our glad voices ring, far into this fine summer night. Dwapple and Blenny, the mole babe, dashed forward. Seizing Krega's huge paws, they tugged her toward the feasting tables.
Hee-hee, we frightened you, Badger Mum, but then us sing nice for you.
Boor, marm, do we come now? We am got gort eaps of vittles for ee, and you am can stay up late with us'ns.
The blind badger allowed herself to be led to the festive table. Seating herself in the big abbot's chair, she took both bibbons on her lap, joking with the little creatures.
I must say you did frighten me dreadfully, but that lovely song made me feel lots better. Thank you. Can we really stay up late tonight? Then I'll behave myself and be extra good. I smell blueberry and almond turnovers. Pass me the dish, please. I'm so hungry, I think I'll eat 'em all.
Dwapple shook his spoon severely at the massive old badger.
Titch, titch. Thought you said you was gonna behave. Friar Butty send you back up to bed if you naughty.
Outside, the night was still, the day's heat still radiating from the sun-warmed stones of the wall-top. A half-moon stood clear in endless plains of dark velvet sky. At the center of the south rampart, Bargle stood talking to the shrew Mayen on reluctant guard duty.
What do you think the chances are of Florian and his patrol coming up here to relieve us so as we can get to the feast?
Bargle shook his head at Mayen's simple and trusting nature.
You got more chance of sprouting wings and fluttering away like a butterfly, matey. Imagine old Florian and Skipper pushing woodland trifle down their faces, then saying all of a sudden like,
"Better hurry up. We gotta go and relieve the wall guards."
Mayen tried to imagine it, then sighed regretfully.
"You're right, mate. 'Twouldn't happen in 10 seasons of plenty. Oh, well, maybe they'll leave us some for breakfast. I hope."
The 4 marl foxes crouched in the ditch. Behind them, a contingent of water rats waited, holding the siege ladder between them. Jeltor hauled himself stealthily up onto the path. When he held his voluminous cloak still, he was almost invisible against the ditch edge and the path. At his signal, the rats crawled out of the ditch, taking care to make no noise with the long, rough ladder. Silently, Jeltor fastened it to one end of the rope that had been left hanging from the protrusion beneath the battlements near the northwest corner. The ladder rose smoothly upward as several rats hauled slowly on the rope's other end. When the ladder was raised to its full extent, Jeltor maneuvered it firmly against the wall and nodded to the others waiting in the ditch. Vannon, Askrod, and Predak led the remainder of the water rats to the bottom of the ladder. Gripping his axe handle in tight clenched teeth, Jeltor began climbing. When he was halfway up, Predak allowed the rats to follow. The Gwasim shrew guarding that area was looking over at Bargle and Mayen, not suspecting a thing. Swift and silent as a shadow passing across the moon, Jeltor slid over the wall-top and slew the sentry. As the rats followed, he gestured to the wall-steps in the northwest corner, whispering,
"Hide down there against the wall and wait for me."
The first group of 10 water rats padded softly down the stairs into the grounds of Redwall Abbey. Mayen yawned and stretched wearily.
"Let's hope that Friar Butty thinks of us and reminds old Florian that we're up here, mate. Ooh, I don't know what's getting to me most, hunger or tiredness. Is that phlegm over at the far corner there? Looks like he's gone asleep."
Bargle stared over toward the shrew in question, who was lying prone.
"Sleeping on the job, is he? Well, I'll soon..."
"Rats! Look it, mate! There's rats climbing over the wall! Log a log a log a log!"
Roused by the Gwasim cry, shrews pounded around from all sides of the wall tops, following Bargle and Mayen to the northwest corner. Jeltor cursed, grinding his teeth.
"Rot their lousy eyes! They've seen us!"
Bargle charged headlong across the ramparts, yelling out orders.
"3 to each wall gate! Mayen, take 6 and secure the main gate! Stop those vermin opening any gates! Splicker, bring the rest and follow me! Charge!"
Jeltor was in a quandary. He could not fight off the charging Gwasim, but neither could he climb back down the ladder against the stream of rats already on it, forging their way upward. Judging the situation hastily, he slipped quietly off down the wall steps.
A water rat was halfway over the wall when he met a thrust from Bargle's rapier and fell back with a gurgle, plunging out over the heads of his upcoming companions. Bargle and three other shrews mounted the battlements, slashing with their blades at any rat foolish enough to attempt climbing further. Below on the ground, Vannon, Askrod, and Predak knew that the plan had been discovered, but they urged their troops on.
"Come on, get up that ladder! You at the top there! Attack! Get on the wall and keep them shrews busy! Fight them!"
Bargle draped himself across the gap between two battlements, and by leaning down as far as he could, managed to catch hold of the rope still tied to the ladder top. The brave shrew hauled on the rope while his mates kept the attackers busy until the free end was at last in his hand. Leaping up, he yelled out commands.
"Some beast get over to the abbey and raise the alarm. There's no beast in the bell tower to warn 'em. The rest of you follow me."
Bargle started running along the tops of the battlements toward the southwest corner, tugging the rope across his shoulders. Wily in the ways of battle, the other Gwasom caught on right away to what he was doing. Climbing up to join him, each one caught hold of the rope and ran with it, pulling furiously. With a loud grating sound, the ladder began heeling over sideways. Rats screeched in panic, caught in a jumble at the top of the ladder, unable to descend because of others clinging on and terror below them. Those lucky enough to be on the low rungs jumped for the safety of the ground, most of them landing on the heads of the bewildered marl foxes below. Unable to topple further, the ladder fell awkwardly, spinning out away from the wall, laden with screaming vermin. It thudded to earth with a sickening crunch, snapping at its center as it hit the ground in a cloud of dust and carcasses. Bargle jumped down from the battlements.
"Down into the grounds, mates. We don't know how many got in."
The shrew running for the abbey to raise the alarm was brought down by an arrow. Mayen had his paws full defending the main gates against Jeltor and the 10 water rats who had made it over the wall. Jeltor was fighting for his life, and he knew it. If he could not force Mayen and his 6 Gwasom away from the main gate, there would be no help from outside now that the ladder had fallen. The marl fox fought like a demon, snarling in the face of his enemies as he wielded his axe savagely. 3 shrews were laid low as Bargle and the rest of his sentries came thundering up to join the fight. Jeltor and his rats saw them coming and dashed away for the south wall gate, where only 3 Gwasom were on guard. The marl fox's mind was racing. If he was fast enough, they could lay the 3 low and escape. Bargle went after them, signaling Mayen to stay with his command at the main gate. One of the shrews running with Bargle was halfway across the lawn, whirling a loaded sling, when he tripped. The heavy pebble shot off into the night. Smash! The stone took out a small window pane in Great Hall. Jangler, Rusville, and Skipper were up and vaulting over the tabletops even before the final shards of crystal glass had finished falling. Boracle was hard on their heels, blocking the doorway through which the trio had just exited.
"Friar, Deesum, Slowey, get those dibbins to the wine cellars. Craga, you and the elders, hold this door. Every other able-bodied Redwaller, follow me."
Florian brushed past him in high indignation.
"Humph! Just what I was about to say myself. Don't anticipate my orders in the future. Thunder in bad form, sir."
Troglo Spearback could not help raising his eyebrows as he patted Boracle's back.
"Oh, dearie me. You've got Mr. Florian really roused now, mate. I wonder who he's going to attack with that bowl of puddin' that he's carrying."
Jeltor had lost the fray. Bargle and his Gwasom hurled themselves upon the water rats with all the skill and ferocity of shrew warriors. They took no prisoners. Jeltor was backed up against the wall gate, surrounded by a half-circle of rapier blades, when Janglor, Rusville, and Skipper arrived on the scene. Bargle staunched a leg wound grimly.
"Big old ladder they had, Skip. But I put paid to that. I think this marl fox here is the last of them."
Some beast held up a torch, and Skipper studied the marl fox and its glow. "Florian, take your guards up on the wall top and secure it. We'll search the grounds and make certain there ain't any more vermin prowling about. Jangler, bind this un, and lock him in the gatehouse until we decides what to do with him." Jeltor flailed about dangerously with his axe.
"Put a paw near me and it gets chopped off."
The half-lidded eyes of Jangler settled on the marl fox.
"Tough beast, ain't you, fox? You're the one who was going to execute me for sending your sister where she belongs."
The marl fox spat at the warrior squirrel and bared his fangs.
"Talk big with your army round, you windbag. You couldn't face me alone if I was bound and blindfolded."
Skipper smiled pityingly at the marl fox.
"Oops,
I think you just said the wrong thing there, matey.
Jangler waved a paw at those surrounding the cornered Jeltor.
Back off, every beast. Do like I say and stand well away.
Rustful shouldered his javelin and prepared to stride off.
Best do like Jangler says. Where do you want us, Jang?
Jangler's eyes never left the fox as he replied,
Over yonder, out of the way.
The squirrel warrior nodded at the Marl Fox's axe.
You can keep hold of that thing. Now, let's do this proper. Walk past me, fox, about 3 tall tree lengths, out onto the lawn.
Jeltor was mystified, but he complied, feeling the squirrel's lazy eyes watching him as he paced off the distance.
Right. That'll do, you vermin. Stop there.
Jeltor halted and turned to see Jangler whack the bolts back with 2 sharp movements and fling open the south wall gate. Jangler moved forward a few paces. Standing empty-pawed between Jeltor and the open gate, he addressed the fox.
See? There's freedom. An open gate. All you got to do is get past me. Don't fret. No beast will try to stop you, only me.
Jeltor spat on his axe blade and swung it expertly, feeling light-headed with confidence. What sort of fools were these abbey dwellers, leaving only a fat-bellied, sleepy-looking squirrel between a marl fox and his freedom? He ran a short distance forward, sprang into a crouch with the keen axe flat-bladed in front of him, and began stalking his prey. Jangler waited until Jeltor was less than a pace from him. Then, as the axe swung, he dropped to the ground, kicking out sharply. Jeltor went down on his tail with a grunt of surprise. He had never missed a beast with his axe at that range. A sickening pain shot through his left footpaw, and he scrambled upright, to find himself facing the squirrel whirling a stone-loaded sling. Limping, Jeltor took 2 sharp sideways chops at his adversary, snarling angrily,
When I leave here, I'll take your head with me, Redwaller.
Jangler countered a blow, the stone in his sling ringing off the axe blade. He swung and caught Jeltor in the stomach.
Save your breath, bully. Are you going to talk or fight?
The Marl Fox feinted to draw Jangler off, then swung an overhead slice directly between his opponent's eyes. But the squirrel was not there. Jangler had moved his position so that he was standing alongside his assailant. The momentum of the swing buried the axe blade in the earth, and the thwack of the stone-loaded sling echoed off the south wall as it struck Jeltor's skull. Jangler took the axe from the slain Marl Fox's limp grasp, passing it to Troglo's spearback.
This weapon's seen enough evil. Put it to work in your cellars, chopping up old barrel staves. Skip, get those slain rats.
He hooked a paw in Jeltor's belt and dragged him outside the wall gate, where he dumped the dead Marl Fox on open ground.
Put them out here with their master. I told them they could bury their own when they started this.
When the gate was secured, they started back for the abbey, Skipper and Jangler supporting Bargle, who sported a makeshift bandage on his wounded leg. Rustful ruffled the shrew's ears fondly.
That's a wound to show your grand shrews, mate.
The tough Blossom limped forward with all speed.
Ha! Never mind that. Is the feast still going good?
Me and McCrew been waiting on a relief since nearly noon, and we're starving.
Florian called down anxiously from the wall top.
I say, old chap, if you see a half-finished woodland trifle pudding, well, it's mine, so don't put a blinkin' paw near it, what?
Righto, mate, Bargle called cheerily back.
I swear I won't touch your trifle. Can't say the same thing for Mayan, though. He loves his trifle, nothing does. Cads! Trifle burglars! Have you no sense of honor, sirs? Leaving a poor creature up here in charge of your jolly worthless hides while you plunder his trifle? This'll go on your record, I warn you. Great shrew-faced vittle vulture.
Mayan began ragging Florian ruthlessly.
Are you partial to mushroom and cheese flans, sir, or anything of that sort? Just you tell us what dishes are your favorite, Mr. Florian.
The hare's reply was tinged with hopefulness.
Well, thank the seasons for a decent type of shrew, what? Yes, mushroom and cheese flan. That's jolly nice. Oh, let me see now. I like summer salad with hazelnuts, blueberry pudding, hot scones with meadow cream, lashings of the stuff. Apple pie, plum tart, heavy fruit cake with a wedge of cheese, anything like that.
Mayan nodded, as if making a mental note of it all.
Well, don't you fret, sir. We'll remove all that jolly old temptation out of your way, so that your britches'll still fit your... Don't forget to put that on our record, sir.
They went inside, chuckling, with the air ringing to Florian Dougal Wolf Wolfachop's invective.
Blisterin' salad swipers! Confounded purloiners of puddin's!
you mop-pawed, rag-headed bread-and-cheese bandits. I hope you all scoff too much and explode. See if I'll care. Ha! Pish and tush, I'll say. Fiddle-dee-hay, and serves em right. Why, I've a good mind to go to sleep, and allow the flippin' place to be overrun with water foxes and marl rats, and what have you. Porter boxes and ragmats. Yes, that's what I mean. No, tisn't.
21. Morning was high and bright by the time the travelers left Solitree's dwelling with their guide. Song had the feeling that though the hedgehog giant professed to be happy with his lonely existence, he would dearly have wished them to stay longer. In normal circumstances, the squirrel maid would have liked to, but there was much to be done, and now was not the time to linger. With their packs refilled from Saul's larder, they trudged off, their big friend in the lead carrying the boat Swallow across his shoulders with ease. Dan figured that the path they were taking must once have been flooded by water, for thick fern beds, interspersed with clumps of marjoram, woundwort, and hemp nettle, grew around the slender trunks of young rowan, elder, and ash, which provided a veritable palisade on either side of the narrow path. Apart from the birdsong all around, there appeared to be no signs of other creatures.
"Looks like we got the woodlands to ourselves, mates,"
Dippler remarked airily. Saul's reply caused them to look to their weapons.
"Not quite, me young dears. We're being watched. Now, put not your paws near blade or sling. There's nothing a beast of my girth cannot deal with. Follow me. Look neither left nor right, and be not afeard."
"Oh, yes, yes. Keep close to the big feller, though I don't see as how he'll defend us,"
Burble whispered to Dippler as they hurried to keep up with Saul.
"Yesterday he said that 'twas again his nature to be a warrior or harm any living creature."
Dippler kept close behind the hedgehog's broad back. He had confidence in Saul. "Don't you worry, Burb. Mr. Saul will take care of us." Song's sharp eyes soon picked out the shapes flitting amid the screen of slim tree trunks. Whoever it was tracking them seemed well-versed in stealth, using sunlight and shadow skillfully, slipping between ferns and bushes. "Whatever kind of creature comes at us, I'm not afraid," Dan murmured to her. "This time they won't catch me napping, I'll wager."
The pretty squirrel maid restrained Dan's sword paw gently.
"I know you don't fear them, Dan, but let's do what Saul says. Just follow and leave things to him. Look out, here they are." There were three of them, a stoat and two weasels. Their appearance was eerie and barbaric. Stripes of yellow clay and green plant dye swathed the trio from ears to footpaws, providing perfect camouflage for the type of woodland they hunted in. A mace and chain dangled from the stoat's paw, while the weasels brandished fire-blackened cutlasses. They stood on the path ahead, boldly blocking the way. Grinning wickedly, the stoat twirled his mace and chain.
"Stay where you are. This is our forest. Who said yous could walk on our path? I never did, you cullies."
The weasels were enjoying themselves. They shook their heads.
"Nah, we never gave them permission. Trespassing, that's what they're doing."
Saul unshouldered the boat, placing it carefully to one side. His voice was calm and friendly.
"Me and my friends are travelers. We don't want trouble."
The stoat turned to his weasel companions, putting on a mocking tone.
"Did you hear that, buckos? They don't want trouble. Ain't that nice?"
Turning swiftly, he slammed the spiked metal ball of his mace and chain against a thin laburnum tree, tearing off a chunk of bark. His voice hardened as he shook the weapon at the hedgehog.
"Well, you've already got trouble, whether you want it or not. Now drop those food packs, and your weapons too, and leave the pretty boat where 'tis. Then run back the ways you came, and I'll let you off with your lives. But you better do it quick."
Saul held up a large paw.
"I hear you, friend. Let me have a word with these young'uns first."
Without waiting for a reply, Saul turned and addressed his followers quietly.
"Steady now, my little dears. I know you're warriors, and you could deal with yon vermin. But why waste life? They're only bullies and loudmouths, or they'd have acted before now. Leave this to Saul."
The giant hedgehog turned back then and took a few resolute steps forward. Seeing the size of him reared up to his full height, the vermin trio fell back a pace. Saul's face was stern and unrelenting, and his voice rang like iron.
"You see those four young'uns back there? Well, each of them is a Redwall Abbey champion.
They're born warriors. Any one of them could lay all three of you out.
Both weasels looked apprehensive at the statement, but the stoat kept up his swagger.
You're lying, Edge Pig. Those four, ha! I'll wager that 4 seasons back their mamas was still tucking them in bed.
Saul raised his bushy eyebrows, widening his eyes until he began to look quite insane, and his voice rose to a roar.
But I only keep my friends for special occasions, and this ain't nothing special. 3 painted popinjays like you, you're all mine.
Saw's powerful paws began clenching and unclenching. His eyes popped even wider, and his voice swelled like thunder.
"'Cause you've left it until too late to run away now. You must deal with me. I'm the son of a gut-ripper and skull-crusher, born in Dark Moon and Storm. My enemies don't have graves. I ate them all. First I'll bite off your ears and tails. Then I'll build me a great fire, a roasting fire. I'll cut me a sharp green spit, one that can take 3 vermin at a time. Then I'll get my skinning sword, and I'll—'
But the vermin were gone, whizzing away through the woodlands like minnows with a pike on their tails. Solitary sat down on the path, placing a paw across his eyes and shaking his head woefully.
"'Oh, dearie me. Grapevines and gravel. Dearie goodness gracious me!'
Song hurried forward and held his paw sympathetically. "'Mr. Saul, whatever's wrong with you?' The giant hedgehog waved her away.
"'Leave me a moment, my pretty maid. I've gone and upset myself with all that temper and shouting. It had to be done, though I don't like myself when I must resort to anger. Leave me, I beg you.'
Song went with her friends to sit a short distance from Saul. Dan's eyes were shining with wonder.
"'Did you see him? Phew!
Imagine what he'd have done if the vermin had stayed. I shudder to think.'
Dippler had enjoyed the encounter immensely, once he was over the first fright of Saul's roaring tirade.
"'Hee-hee-hee! Did you see their faces? I thought they was going to break all their teeth. They was chattering so hard, eh, Burb?' "'Oh, yes, yes. Myself, I was hoping that good old Mr. Saul would skin 'em and roast the rotten toads, like he said he would. Yes.'
Song tweaked the water bowl's ear.
"'You bloodthirsty little maggot! Mr. Saul wouldn't have done any such thing!' He knew they were only bullies, so he out-bullied them. Look at him, poor creature. He's quite upset.
However, Saul's depressed state did not last too long. He sniffed quite a bit, wiped his eyes, and stood up, smiling broadly.
Well, that's enough of that, my little dearies. There's plenty of creatures in this land to upset me, without my upset myself. Life is given to be lived happily. That's true enough.
Picking up the mason chain that the stoat had dropped, Saul twirled it above his head until it was a humming blur. Then he flung it up and out. They watched in awe as it sailed out of sight over the treetops. About mid-afternoon, Saul changed course slightly, veering off into an area where the trees were less thick, and small clearings and rocks dotted the land.
"'I hope you don't mind, my dearies, but I got a little visiting to do. 'Twon't take up much of your time.'
Dippler sniffed the air appreciatively.
"'Ooh, lovely. Scones. Some beasts baking scones. I can smell 'em.'
Sure enough, a wonderful aroma of fresh-baked scones hovered elusively on the hot afternoon air. Saul halted and called out in a gentle sing-song tone,
"'Goodwife Brim, are you at home? If and you are, 'tis only me. Now you won't sit all alone, 'cause I've brought some friends to tea.'
A voice, old and cracked through long seasons, answered him,
"'Niffin, that's who I think it be. What a den you're making. Seems to me I only see your face when I'm baking.'
Laughing uproariously, Saul hitched the swallow farther up on his shoulders and broke into a lumbering run, with the 4 travelers trotting in his wake. Goodwife Brem was a small, thin otter, incredibly old. Her fur had turned a beautiful silver-white. Song had never seen an old otter-wife dressed so charmingly, from her poke bonnet and puff-sleeved gown to the flowery pinafore with dainty lace edging. The goodwife's home was properly built from baked clay and mud bricks, walling in a flat, almost square rock spur, which formed the roof. White limestones separated her vegetable and herb garden from a blossoming flower patch. The old otter left off gathering rows of scones from a window ledge, where they had been cooling, and hobbled forward to greet her friend. Saul and Goody Brim hugged and kissed fondly.
My old goody-goody. Prettiest otter and best cook anywheres. Saul, you big flatterer, your singing ain't improved none.
So it hasn't, Marm. But I got one ear can out-sing larks.
Saul introduced them, while Goody Brim kissed their cheeks and squeezed their paws right heartily for one so frail-looking.
Fortune smile on them. Ain't they so young and beautiful, Saul? My, my, swords and slings and rapiers, proper young warriors all. Come in and sit. I was about to put the kettle on.
Inside was the neatest, tidiest house they had ever seen. A brightly hued rush mat covered the floor from wall to wall. Pottery ornaments graced the highly polished dresser. There were even embroidered linen headrests on the chair backs. Goody Brim put a sizable copper kettle over the fire to boil. Then, rolling mint leaves and dried burnet rose hips, almost to powder, with a long round stone, she tossed them in a fat blue teapot. Tea at Goody Brim's house was very special. The travelers helped themselves to almond wafers and scones, spread with every kind of preserve from black currant jelly to gooseberry and damson jam. Saul hauled two bags from his pack.
Brought you some grapes and almonds. Good crop this year.
They explained their mission to the otter wife, who listened, sipping her tea and nodding, while encouraging them to eat more. When they had finished their tale, the old goodwife spoke.
The stream flows well not far from here. Saul will have you there by eventide, so don't gollop your food and rush off now. Lack-a-day, young'uns are always in a hurry. Slow down, 'tis better for you. Now then, pretty miss, with a name like yourn, I think you should carry a nice tune. Do you know one called Mother Nature Dear? 'Tis a great favorite of mine.
Song answered without hesitation.
Aye, I know it well, Marm. My grandma Elio taught it to me. 'Twas a long time ago, but I recall every word.
Goody chuckled and winked at Saul.
A long time ago, eh? Like as not two seasons back. When you're old as me, then you can talk about long times, my beauty.
Come, sing for me. Song began tapping her footpaw, and they all tapped along with her until the rhythm was just right to start singing.
Who taught the birds to sing? Why, Mother Nature dear. Who told the winds and breeze to blow, rain to fall and snow to snow, rivers to run and streams to flow, O Mother Nature dear? Who colored grass so green, why Mother Nature dear? Who tells the moon come out at night and teaches stars to shine so bright, then orders sun and clear daylight, O Mother Nature dear? Who makes the seasons change, why Mother Nature dear? Who says the seas must ebb and flow, and tells each tree how tall to grow, then lets the days pass fast or slow. O Mother Nature dear, I see her plain and clear. She's all around us here.
Song held the final note, letting it rise, holding it a touch longer, then ending with a double tap of her footpaws. Goody Brim was smiling, yet she wiped her eyes with a small kerchief.
I never heard that tune sung so sweet in all my days. 'Twas a rare treat just to sit and listen to your voice, young missy.
Saul rose reluctantly.
That's true, my dear, but these young'uns got a ways to go afore nightfall. We best leave now if and we want to make it to the stream by twilight. So we'll be bidding you goodbye.
Goody Brim hastily started wrapping scones for them.
Goodbye, nothing. I'll walk with you as far as the stream. A stretch of the old paws'll do me good.
Afternoon shadows were growing long as they strode through the woodland in double file, chatting away animatedly. Dan watched the old otter, leaning for support on Saul's sturdy paw. Both solitary creatures united for a short time. Song already had an idea of what Dan was going to say to her, but she let him speak his thoughts as they walked together.
I can't help feeling sorry for Saul and Goody. You can tell they lead a lonely life by the way they love company and want us to stay and visit longer. I think they'd be far better off living at Redwall Abbey. There'd be lots of new friends there, and things to do. I bet they'd soon forget their loneliness at the Abbey.
Song had already pondered this idea.
Ah, but you must remember, Dan, they're solitary creatures by choice.
I'll grant you that they like visitors. But if they were to live at the Abbey, perhaps they wouldn't be able to get used to constant company and living night and day without the solitude they've come to love so well. Besides, Saul and Goody are old and set in their ways. I don't think they'd take so easily to a new life.
Goody Brim turned and winked at Song.
Right, my beauty. You show great wisdom for one so young.
The squirrel maid felt her fur prickle with embarrassment.
Oh, Marm, I'm sorry. I didn't realize I was speaking so loud.
Goody's head nodded up and down as she chuckled.
Hee-hee, you weren't. Sometimes my old paws let me down, but these ears of mine are sharp as the day I was born. What's more, when I hear your voice echoing round this great boat that Saul's carrying, it sounds a lot louder, I can tell you. Hee-hee.
Burble agreed with the old otter.
Ah, yes, yes, missus. I carried that boat over me head with these three for nigh on a day. Do you know, they near drove me mad with their chattering and singing echoing through me poor young ears. Yes.
Dippler stared at the water vole quizzically.
Did I hear right, matey? Some beast near drove you mad by chattering? Are you sure 'twasn't the other way round, eh?
Several rivulets joined in a small valley to form the stream. In the gathering twilight, they heard the water sounds as they trekked through the trees toward it. Simple pleasure showed on Saul's heavy face.
You see, me little dearies, I told you I'd get you here afore dark, and I was right, was I not?
Placing the swallow on stream, Saul held it still while the four friends stowed their supplies, climbed into the vessel, and took up their paddles. Then Saul and Goody Brim bid them farewell.
Go ye now, and fortune sail with you, my dearies. Aye, and make them scones last well. 'Twill be a long time till you taste any so nice.
Should you return safe from your venture, be so kind as to call and visit old Saul again some sunny day.
You must all come and see me, too, but stay a bit longer next time. Be careful now, go safe, and take our best wishes with you.
The swallow cut her way out to midstream, with the four friends calling their goodbyes to the two good creatures waving from the bank.
Thanks for everything, both of you. We'll come back, never fear.
Aye, a gwasome nose can scent scones bacon anywhere, Marm.
Yes, yes. Tell me friend Croytle to have more jokes ready when we call back this way, sir.
Farewell, Saul. Farewell, Goody. We'll never forget you or the kindness you have shown us. Farewell.
Watching the sleek craft slide downstream until it was lost in the nightfall, Hedgehog and Otter stood silent, tears dripping down their faces. Goody Brim passed Saul her kerchief.
They got a long and dangerous way to go, but they're young and brave of heart. They'll make it.
The giant hedgehog dabbed gently at his eyes.
Wish they could have stayed safe with me and Croykle.
22. Florian Duggle-Wolf Wolfachop struck his most noble pose. Balancing high on the midwest battlements, he leaned forward, shading his eyes with a paw. Back leg stuck out straight behind, and his expression one of keen and courageous intelligence, as he peered searchingly in all directions. The fearless commander, master of all he surveyed.
"All clear!"
he called to the sentries in his most authoritative voice.
"The enemy hath fled from our gates. Nary a sign of one louse-bound rat or malicious marl fox to be seen in all this fair country, what?"
Deesum clasped her paws together fervently.
"Oh, thanks be to fortune. Is the fighting over now?"
Florian blew out his narrow chest, placing a paw upon his heart.
"The winds of war blow no more, madam. The foe beast is vanquished, routed by our valorous efforts. Retreating in disarray, what?
The fiendish mouse-babed Waffle narrowly missed the hare's tail with a stone from his sling. He scowled ferociously.
"War am talking about?"
Florian cast a jaundiced eye at his one remaining foe.
"If you'd washed your pesky ears out, you'd have heard first time, O small and horrible one. Victory is ours. Toll the bells. Strew rose petals round my paws, and prepare a great feast."
Brother Melilot rolled his eyes skyward in despair.
"I had a feeling he was going to mention food."
The rest of the Redwallers, sitting on the gatehouse steps, looked to Crega. Sister Slowey touched the badger's paw. "What do you think, Badger Mum? Is the fighting really over?" Crega deliberated before giving her answer.
"It could well be, friend. Another marl fox slain, and a good number of water rats. Perhaps they've had enough. They've not shown up today so far, and that must be a good sign."
Gerbil Sellermole jumped up and down with joy. She hated the notion, as most other Redwallers did, of continued strife.
"Oh, do say ye vermits be'd gone, marm. Ye foightin' do be's over, bain't it? Do ye say 'tis?"
Kregge smiled. She could feel the hopefulness virtually radiating from the Abbey dwellers gathered around her.
Oh, all right, if you wish. I think the war's over.
Joyous pandemonium rang out over the grounds into the sun-kissed morning.
Victory for Red Wall! Sound the bells good and loud. A feast! Let's prepare a great feast in the orchard.
Florian strutted triumphantly down the wall steps, bowing to all around in the most outrageous manner.
Jolly well told you, chaps, didn't I? Fightin's over, what?
Jangler sat on the northwest wall corner with his friends, Rusville and Skipper. They watched the cheering creatures pouring over toward the abbey, eager to begin the preparations for the celebratory feast. Jangler's hooded eyes swept Mossflower woodlands north of the ramparts.
Let them enjoy themselves. I think I'll just linger round here for a few days yet. No point in taking chances, mates.
Skipper tested a longbow that he had been restringing.
Good idea. We're with you.
Vannon's was the strongest personality of the three remaining Marlfoxes. She had ordered a retreat into the depths of South Mossflower. The vixen sat watching the water rats tend their injuries and cooked food over an open fire, remarking noncommittally as Askrod came to sit beside her,
"We're fortunate there's no shortage of victuals hereabouts. Let 'em rest a while. We need to use brains more than weapons now."
Askrod snorted scornfully. He snatched a roasted thrush from a passing water rat and sank his teeth into it.
"We need reinforcements more than anything, sister. We've barely got 120, counting me, you, and Predak."
Vannon stood up, brushing her cloak off.
"Then we'll just have to use the ferrets, won't we?"
Askrod spat a bone into the fire, wrinkling his face in disgust.
"What? You mean that scurvy bunch we rousted out of here last night? Raventail and his ragged crowd? They looked as though they'd seen enough fighting to last them many a long day. Anyway, ferrets have never served those of Marlfox blood. Surely you cannot be serious."
Vannon adjusted the axe in her belt so it was ready to paw.
"I'm perfectly serious, brother. We can't be too choosy in times like these, and we need more soldiers. Those ferrets will join us, aye. They'll fight and die for us, too,
when I put a bit of discipline into their backbones.
You can come with me. Bring an escort of 20, well armed. Olog's patrol will do."
Askrod tossed the roast bird aside, wiping paws upon his cloak.
"But we chased them off. They'll be long gone by now."
Vannon pointed to the telltale wisps rising above the treetops to the south.
"They're still hanging about over that way. I've been marking the smoke of their campfire since early morning. Are you coming?"
Askrod signaled Olog's patrol and hurried to join his sister.
"But there was no more than 20 of them. What use is 20 ferrets to us?"
Vannon strode confidently onward.
20 is all we counted, but I'll wager they can raise 3 times that number. 60 extra soldiers is not something to be sneezed at. Let's go and talk to this chieftain Raventail."
When they reached the ferret camp, Vannon ordered Askrod to stay concealed nearby in the woods with Olog and his patrol. Using all the considerable wiles of a Marlfox, she made her way through the ferrets unheeded. Drawing as close to Raventail's fire as she could while remaining undetected, the vixen tossed a pawful of special ingredients from her belt pouch into the flames. Raventail shot up in alarm when the fire burst into a green sheet of flame, followed by a thick column of smoke. He was even more astounded by the appearance of Vannon, who materialized out of the haze. The ferret staggered backward, drawing his scimitar.
"Kayar! Where come are you from, fox-beast?"
Vannon made a fearful sight, paws akimbo, revealing the axe she carried beneath her cloak, from under which the smoke still wreathed and curled. Her strange pale eyes narrowed as she glared at the ferret, calling out in a sepulchral voice,
"Be still, and know that I am the Marlfox. The power of great magic is within me."
Raventail wavered, not sure what to do next. He looked to an old toothless ferret, reputed to be wise, and the old vermin nodded his head vigorously. He, too, was impressed by Vannon's appearance.
"Yea, yea, me know about her Marlfoxes. Raka, raka. Much, much magic."
As if to confirm his statement, Askrod stepped out from a tree behind Vannon, causing widespread consternation among the ferrets.
"Kayar! See two beasts now! Shalaka!
Marlfox and Marlfox. Bannon's lips scarcely moved as she whispered to Askrod,
Well done, brother. We've got these ignorant savages' attention.
She raised a paw imperiously, pointing beyond to the woodland.
Behold the warrior servants of the Marlfoxes!
Alag and his patrol marched out of the trees in double ranks. The ferrets turned around to watch the smartly clad water ants. By the time Alag's soldiers arrived at Raventail's fire, both Marlfoxes had disappeared. Raventail circled the fire, utterly astonished.
Kai-ar! Where go Marlfoxes?
Askrod and Vannon had circled back to where Alag's patrol had been previously hidden. They emerged from the trees, walking very slowly and looking mysterious. The ferret chieftain grabbed the paw of the ancient one he had consulted before.
Yea, all magic Marlfox be big magic.
Vannon muttered out of the side of her mouth to Askrod as they approached the awe-stricken Raventail.
Let's sit down and do business with this one, now that we've convinced him Marlfoxes are really magic.
Florian was also impressing an audience at that moment. Armed with a soup ladle and a large wooden salad fork, he pranced about wildly in front of the Abbey Babes, performing a victory ode he had composed, in which credit for the rout of the vermin was due largely to the fighting prowess of one Florian Dugglewolf Wolfachop.
Armed to the dirty mangy teeth, 10 of them came at me. Ho, ho, me buckles, here, says I, only 10 of ye? So I boxed their ears and blacked their eyes, then tied their tails in knots. I kicked their bottoms o'er the walls with javelins and slingshots. When suddenly behind me back, some foul beast shouted, Charge! And 23 came right at me. Those villains were quite large. So I got me trusty salad fork and jabbed em here and there. I left em weeping full of holes. Oh, save us from that hare! Well, I grabbed a fleeing Marlfox and punched him on the snout. Both his boots went flying off. I gave him such a clout. Those rats were dirty fighters. Out came me old soup ladle. The cowardly pack of blighters fled fast as they were able. I chased him, laughing bravely. Ha-ha, now, off you pop. I'm the warrior who saved Redwall, and my last name's Wilfachop.
Unknown to the garrulous hare, Bargle and Mann were watching the performance. The two gwasome shrews sat concealed by a berry hedge, observing Florian's wild contortions as he declaimed his outrageous ode. They were not sure whether to scowl or laugh.
Modest old beast, ain't he, mate? I wonder who taught him to dance. A mad caterpillar? Even a scalded frog couldn't prance about like that. I've never seen a creature's paws, tail, ears, and whiskers go in so many different ways at one time. Oh, ha-har-har! Old Florian's fell flat on his tail. I knew he would. Couldn't keep up a twirling jig like that.
Sister Slowey, assisted by Rimrose and Elio, was checking up on Redwallers who had sustained injuries during the fighting. A line formed on the stairs to the infirmary. The patients, mainly shrews, who had slingshot or arrow wounds that needed redressing. Rimrose finished neatly bandaging a gwasome paw.
There you are, Splicker. Good as new. Keep it dry now. That cut is healing nicely. Next.
Elio and Slowey were applying a compress of wet herbs to the head of a mole who had been hit by a slingstone.
Don't worry, sir. That bump is smaller than 'twas yesterday. Do you still feel dizzy at all?
The mole touched a heavy digging claw to the swelling on his brow.
I be fine now, thank ye, Morm. Don't feels like I gotten two heads no more, hor-hor.
There was a commotion on the stairway. Florian was pushing his way to the front of the line.
I say, make way for a warrior, you chaps. Pish and tush. Load of scratches and bumps, what? A fellow could be dying for all you flippin' lot care. Out of the confounded way, sir.
He came barging into the infirmary, but did a smart about turn when he saw three females in attendance.
Harumph. Not to worry, ladies. I'll come back another time. Extremely busy. Lots to do. What?
Elio and Sister Slowey cut off his retreat to the door.
What seems to be the matter, Mr. Florian?
You never reported a wound. Sit down and tell us about it.
Rather not sit down, Elio, marm.
Florian blustered, backing up to the wall.
Nature of the wound, don't you know?
Ha-ha.
Sister Slowey nodded understandingly.
Oh, I see. You were wounded in the tail area. Why didn't you come here yesterday? Well, didn't feel so jolly bad then, you understand. Just today, though. Been giving me a bit of jip. Must have been a few arrows or a couple of spears got me. Forgot all about it in the heat of battle, you know. Chap doesn't like to cause a fuss.
Rimrose began gathering herbs for a poultice.
Oh, you poor creature, you must have been in great pain.
Florian turned sideways, showing his noble profile and devil-may-care smile.
Oh, 'twas nothing, really. Stiff upper lip, what?
Winking and grinning at every beast about, Bargle and Mahon entered the infirmary. Each tossed a broken half of a wooden salad fork on the table.
Mr. Florian, sir, what's Brother Melilot going to say when he sees what you did to his salad fork?
Aye, I'll wager it smarted a bit when you fell and sat down on it like that. Must have give you a nasty jab in your backside, sir.
Over the uproarious laughter from the shrews waiting in line, Elio gave the hare a piece of her mind.
You great flop-eared fraud, wounded by spears and arrows during the fightin', eh? You're a fiddle-faced fibber and a trickster.
The infirmary door slammed before Florian could make good his escape. Wassum shrews crowded around the outside, peeping through the keyhole and pressing their ears to the woodwork to witness what was taking place inside.
I'll come back tomorrow, Marm. What are you doing with those bally great tweezers? No, please, I beg you.
Yeah!
Bargle, man, hold him still. There may be splinters. Don't want to leave them in there, do we?
Ooh, I say go easy there. Yow-chouch!
Is that water hot enough yet, Rimrose? I want to make a nettle poultice. Can't be too careful with tail wounds.
Eek! Assassins! Help me, some beast! They're torturing me to death! Ow, 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 ow!
So brave and silent, ain't he, man?
Woo! Fiends! Get off! Let me go! Ooh-hoo-hoo!
Stiff upper lip, Mr. Florian. That's the jolly old spirit. Chin up and never say die, old chap. What, what?
Brother Melilot and Ronktip were setting up the banqueting board in the orchard. Gubbio Formole and Troglo Spearback upended a cask onto a trestle, and Troglo knocked home a spigot with his bung mallet. He held a beaker beneath the tap, allowing a small quantity of sparkling pinkish liquid to flow into it. Melilot took the proffered beaker and sipped.
Best strawberry fizz cordial I ever tasted.
Ronktip sat on the ground, looping a thin wire about the big white celery cheese he was about to cut.
Lend a paw here, brother. 'Tis too much for me to cut alone.
Melilot clapped a paw to his forehead.
Pear and chestnut flans. I've left 6 of them in the ovens.
He hurried off, calling back orders.
Troglo, help cut the cheese, will you? Formo, send some of your crew to collect those oat varls from the windowsills. They should be well cooled by now. Roop, Muggle, start loading the trolleys. Don't forget the salad. Oh, and see if you can find my serving fork. I don't know where 'tis gone to. Decent, Marm, would you be kind enough to top off the trifle? We'll find fresh chopped fruit on the big stone slab.
Oh, dear, I hope those flans aren't burnt. Troglo and Ronktip pulled the wire smoothly through the large cheese, then lifted off the moist white circular slice and cut it into 4 wedge-shaped chunks, ready for the table. Ronktip glanced sideways at the berry hedge.
We're being watched, mate. 'Tis probably cheese robbers.
Troglo took his barrel knife and cut a small piece from the cheese, held it up, and called out to the hidden creatures.
You can have some cheese, if you promises not to slay us all afore our work's done here.
The fiendish Dwapple and his cohort, the mole babe Wugger, emerged from behind the hedge. Both dibbins were practically unrecognizable, daubed from ears to tail with gray kitchen ash and flecked with black spots of charcoal. They wore gray blankets, purloined from the dormitory, as cloaks. Stumbling on the blanket hems, they leapt toward the cheese. Troglo struggled to keep a straight face.
And who might you terrible beasts be?
Dwapple turned his most fearsome scowl upon the big hedgehog.
Us be's marm floxes, and you can't see us, 'cause we be invisible.
Troglo caught on to the game right away. He looked strangely at Ronktip, who had also guessed what was going on.
Did you say something, Ray?
Ronktip shook his spiky head vigorously.
I never said a word. I thought 'twas you, mate.
Dwapple sniggered gleefully as he and Wugger grabbed the cheese.
It workin'. Told you they couldn't see us, hee-hee.
Wugger broke the cheese in two, giving half to his partner in crime.
Her. Very good. Usen's best varnish nail, like he marmfloxes.
The heavy digging claws of Gerbold cellar mole descended on them.
You'm bain't a varnishin' nowheres, rogues. I see ye good enough to know you'm be in gort need of a barf and sound scrubbin'.
Both marmfloxes were hauled off, kicking and squealing, by the dutiful mole wife. Added to the scent of the orchard, an aroma of wonderful food created an intoxicating atmosphere. Jangler, Skipper, and Rustful had been temporarily relieved by three good guassum, and were sitting together with Rimrose and Elio. All around them the buzz and chatter of happy creatures added to the festive spirit. Even the very-hued butterflies and bumblebees that hovered about the orchard seemed part of the enchanted afternoon. Craiga Badgermum created an instant hush when she stood to speak.
"Friends, Redwallers, good creatures all, before we carry on to enjoy this sunny day, let me say a few words in the absence of either abbot or abbess. First, let us hope that the Marlfox threat has gone from Mossflower Country. Brave creatures lost their lives in defense of our abbey, and we must remember them always in our minds and hearts. But also we must resolve never to yield to evil, whether it be Marlfox or any other vermin attempting to destroy the peaceful life of Redwall. Next, I feel we should give due thanks to our warriors, Jangluer Swifteye, Rustful Raguba, Vargal Guassum, Skipper of Otters, Boracle, and all of you who defended the abbey. Our thanks to you brave ones."
There was a mass murmur of agreement, which broke out into hearty applause. Craiga waited before continuing.
"Also, we must live in hopes for the safety of Jangluer's daughter Song, Rustful's son Danflor, and the young Guassum Dippler. These, we know now, have gone to get back the tapestry, which is the very heart of Redwall. Fate and fortunes keep them well, and aid them on their quest. Now, before we begin, is there anything that you wish to ask me, friends?"
Troglo Spearback's voice rang out strong and clear.
"Hi, Marm. I want to know why you ain't our abbess. Every beast wishes you were."
Roars of approval and loud cheers echoed everywhere. Skipper was forced to whack the table with his rudder to get order.
"Ahoy! Give Marm a chance, will you?"
"Thanks, Marm. The floor's yours." Craiga nodded gratefully in the otter chieftain's direction.
"Well done, Skip. Redwallers, I once had command when I ruled Salamandastron, the great fortress by the sea. Now I wish to live out my seasons in peace. I can help and advise, but I will not rule. On that, my word is final. So if there are no more questions, we will start the feast."
Vargal held up a paw, grinning mischievously.
"Beg pardon, Marm, but could you tell us why Mr. Florian ain't sitting down like the rest of us?"
Craig's blind eyes turned in the shrew's direction.
"Isn't he? I hadn't noticed. Mayhap Mr. Florian can throw some light upon the mystery, sir?"
Amid gales of laughter from all who knew what had happened, Florian glared daggers at the cheeky shrew.
"Flippin' spiky-mopped water beetle! Mind your own business, what? Chap has the right to stand or sit as he jolly well pleases, without your bottle-nosed inquiries, flamin' fat-bellied boat-robber. Shove some salad down that great gob of yours, and give it a flippin' rest."
"I was just about to do that, sir,"
Bargle shouted cheerfully back.
"But I can't find the salad fork no place."
"But we all trust you, Mr. Florian. You will find it."
Adding insult to injury, Mayen roared out,
"Ah, you'll get to the bottom of things, won't you, sir?"
The outraged hare loaded two plates high with food and marched off, balancing a flagon of October ale between the platters.
"A frog's feather for you lot. I'll go and dine elsewhere. I'm not standing here to be insulted."
"Then sit down, if you dare."
Redwallers held their aching ribs, sobbing with laughter, as much at Bargle's parting shot as at the sight of Florian Dugglewolf Wolfachop strutting off with a heavily bandaged rear end. 23. Late night turned extremely cloudy, leaving the four travelers paddling in complete blackness for long periods when the moon became hidden by heavy cloud banks. The stream had grown much deeper, wider too, and they could no longer feel the odd touch of paddle against stream bed. Dan caught the first overhanging branches that he could reach and hauled them into the bank. "That's enough for one night, pals. The stream may get pretty treacherous in the dark. Let's make camp." Pulling the Swallow up onto dry ground, they sat on a partially mossed rock shelf. Song peered about her, but could not make out much in the thick tree grove surrounding them. "What do you think, Dan? Shall we chance a fire?" The young squirrel was busy digging food out of their packs. I don't see why not, eh, Burb?"
Yes. A bit of an old blaze always cheers things up, and we might see where we've landed, yes."
Dippler went off to look for fuel, and was soon back, staggering under a load of wood. "Found a stricken pine tree back there. Good dry stuff, 'tis." Dan struck flint against his sword blade onto some dry moss, and soon they had a bright crackling little fire. Supper consisted of a few scones, some almonds and raisins, and a brew of Goody Brim's mint and burnet rosehip tea. Only the immediate area of their camp was lit up. Beyond that, the woodland looked thick, dark, and impenetrable. Without warning, a rock whistled out of the night and struck Burble a thudding blow between his shoulders. Dan and Song acted swiftly, dragging the water bowl into the shadows, while Dippler scattered the fire into the stream with the flat of his paddle blade. A mocking voice called out of the woodland to them.
"Yah, you ain't got your big edgehog with you now. We're coming to get yous, me little buckos."
They recognized the voice immediately. It was the stoat whom Saul had chased off, and they had no doubt that his two weasel allies were still with him. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.